Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Today, one of the most distinguished American diplomats joins me here in the studio, Ryan Crocker. He retired from the Foreign Service for the second time in 2012. Crocker's tenure as a diplomat included serving as the U.S. ambassador to six different countries in the Middle East: Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Lebanon, Syria, and Kuwait. Those assignments occurred during the presidencies of George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama. In 2009, Crocker received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He's in town to speak to the World Affairs Council of Charlotte. For details on his speech, go to WFAE.org. Ryan Crocker, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Well, thank you for having me, Eric.
Well, your speech today is entitled Middle East Meltdown, Causes and Consequences. So what are you hoping people will learn or take away from your remarks?
Several things. I hope they will take away that what happens in the world generally is of great importance to us here in America. You know, there is no more Fortress America. We are part of the world, like it or not. And to understand global affairs really is to have the tools you need to succeed in whatever you're doing in this country. That would be one. Two, the Middle East in particular. President Obama spoke hopefully of a pivot to Asia, and certainly tried. But if you pivot to Asia, you're exposing your backside to the Middle East, which if you ignore it, is probably going to take a great big bite out of you. So we need to be engaged there. You do not end wars by withdrawing your forces. You just give the battlefield to the adversary. A lot of challenges coming down the line, and I hope through engagement with the Charlotte World Affairs Council, that will be another step for this very important community.
You travel around the country and deliver speeches on a fairly regular basis, I believe. What's your sense of the mood in the country and understanding around the country about these issues?
Clearly, there's a lot of interest. That is why the World Affairs Council network is so important, almost 100 councils countrywide. Charlotte, incidentally, is one of the very strongest in that council system. So the interest is there. The problem, if you will, is finding the tools to understand what's going on. When you look at our media options out there now, when I was in Beirut in the early 80s, a horrific time, everybody was there. All the networks, all the major papers, including regional papers, and they were everywhere else, Jerusalem, Cairo. That's all gone. There are very few foreign bureaus left for the media. New York Times is managing, Wall Street Journal managing barely, Washington Post, same. As the world gets more complex, our tools to understand it are diminishing.
Before we delve into your experience and perspective on foreign relations, I want to go back to the beginning a little bit, or at least the beginning for you, which is you grew up in an Air Force family. You lived in several countries, I think including Morocco and Turkey, during your childhood. How did you end up pursuing a career in diplomacy?
Well, like a lot of things that happen in everybody's life, maybe mine more than most, kind of by accident. When I was entering my senior year of college, I knew, having had the international exposure that I'd gotten through my dad's assignments, I wanted to be in that arena. In what form, I didn't know. I knew there was a foreign service because I had lived abroad, so I signed up for that exam. I was also talking to the Peace Corps, applying for graduate school overseas in Ireland, talking to Marine recruiters. I didn't know what vehicle would get me there, but I was determined to live in the broader world.
And did you take just a natural interest because of your surroundings in international happenings?
I did. I was fortunate enough to have spent my last 3 years of high school in Turkey, graduated high school there, and with my parents had traveled around the Middle East a bit. And then following a junior year abroad, I hitchhiked from Amsterdam to Calcutta, which is a great way to spend a summer if you're not too interested in living beyond your early 20s. But I did, and that just cemented in my mind that I wanted to be engaged with that broader world and with the Middle East in particular.
And, you know, a lot of people would still, and I'm sure then, but people today as well would look at that as an intimidating part of the world. Why were you comfortable in that part of the world?
Maybe my natural affinity for chaos. I don't really know. I do remember going through, in particular, Iran in the summer of 1970. I was just captivated by the depth of Iranian culture. An advanced civilization going back thousands of years. The same thing in Egypt. So that living history captured me in a way, and frankly, being in an area where you really don't know what's going to happen next presents a certain set of challenges that I was interested in being part of.
And there was an excitement about it, it sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, look, if you're 22 and you're single and the Foreign Service is willing to pay for you to learn a hard language somewhere and then send you off to do whatever, life is good.
You mentioned earlier your time in Lebanon, and of course you survived the embassy bombing in Beirut, and then the rest of your career, you went from hotspot to hotspot. Tell me a little bit about what day-to-day life was like when you were in Beirut, when you were in Syria, when you were in these places where so many bad things were going on.
Well, Beirut was my introduction to the violence and the danger that foreign affairs can pose. Again, I survived the embassy bombing, April 1983. I was there for the Marine barracks bombing 6 months later. I saw an awful lot of good men and women get killed out there and felt that it was really, really important to understand what the forces are that are in play that can lead us from a well-intentioned Marine deployment in Beirut to protect civil order to the horror of the bombing of their barracks and the death of 244 Marines. It was one of those moments in which I thought, I've got the tools, I've studied the language, I've studied the area. I need to be able to step up to these things and give advice and counsel that hopefully would prevent another such tragedy from occurring down the road.
And I wonder at the same time, obviously there has to be some fear or concern for your personal safety, the safety of others, but you're also living day to day. I mean, you have to eat, you have to shop, you have to do all the things that people do day to day. How do those things balance out? Are you always on guard, so to speak?
Like our brothers and sisters in uniform, and I must say I'm personally delighted to see that this week Charlotte's hosting.
You say you came at the perfect time.
I did indeed. Saw some young Marines at the Hilton last night and this morning. It's great to have them there, and it says something about this community that that they're very welcome. You tend to compartmentalize a bit. You cannot be in those situations and just obsess about your own security. You can't. So you just park that off somewhere. You learn, you know, good tradecraft, if you will, to be aware of your surroundings. Don't do dumb stuff. Things like that. But then you got to get on with the job. And I think there are certain protective mechanisms we all have. I remember going down the stairs, heading for the embassy one morning, not telling myself, well, I know how the day's going to start. I got no idea how it's likely to end. It's a civil war going on out there. And being grateful that I didn't know how it would end, I might not have gotten out of bed.
but you did get out of bed. And you not only got out of bed, but you, as I mentioned at the beginning, you wound up being the U.S. ambassador for six different countries in the Middle East. And again, there's so many setbacks, not just in terms of personal safety or your colleagues' safety, but the diplomacy is so difficult. What kept you getting out of bed in that regard?
Well, I learned again several things fairly early on in my career, certainly in Beirut, my first tour there, 81 to 84. It's not a region. Lebanon certainly was not a country then where you would be inclined toward optimism. But what I learned is there's something else. I would call it positivism. You got a plan. You got a plan to get from one day to the next. And you communicate that to those who serve under you. I don't think the defenders of the Alamo were highly optimistic their last morning. But, boy, they had a plan down to the last bullet. And to be thinking in those terms is a way you combat some of the other things you were just mentioning, fear of personal safety, fear for the safety of others, and so forth. You got a plan. It's going to change six times. It's still a plan. You just keep moving.
We're speaking with Ambassador Ryan Crocker today on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I wanted to ask you, going back to your travels around this country and speaking about some of these matters, one of the things that we've heard, I think, almost forever about Americans is that we don't have enough knowledge of these troubled regions, that we're not paying enough attention to the Middle East and other parts of the world. What's your sense of how engaged and how aware Americans are at this point in time?
Well, we're such a vast and diverse country, it really is hard to generalize. One factoid I would cite, again, the World Affairs Councils. They're all the ones that I have visited, they're doing pretty well. They've got popular support. People do want to learn about what's going on out there, and they support their councils. And Charlotte would be a case study of that. We have a very strong council here, strong because it's got a lot of support from the city and the area. So the desire to learn is there. Again, the means of doing that learning have been restricted as the core of foreign correspondence has progressively shrunk. Again, why the councils are important. Americans would like to know, why did we go into Iraq? What's the consequence? Where does that go next? We've been in Afghanistan for 17 years. How long is that war going on and for what end? Tell us. Some skepticism I encounter, you'd like to see that. I have been kind of pleasantly surprised that in my engagements with these councils, not a lot of people there to push their particular viewpoint forward. It's tell us what this means. With that spirit out there, I think that's really important for our future.
What kinds of questions do you hear most often in terms of, does it tend to be nuts and bolts? Does it tend to be policy? And I know I'm generalizing here, but just your kind of impression of what people most want to know.
What I have seen generally is the big picture. What are the U.S. interests today, now? Why are we in a place like Afghanistan? What about East Asia? Is China the next global threat to us? Is it going to be like the Soviet Union all over again? So it's kind of these big picture concerns out there, which is just what it should be. If you can get the picture framed right, then the more specific issues will be inside that framework, easier to get at if you've managed to get the big concepts down. You know, where are we in the world in 2018?
We are going to try to get some of those big concepts down when we continue here on Charlotte Talks. We're speaking with Ambassador Ryan Crocker, and I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and my guest today is former Ambassador Ryan Crocker, who is speaking to the World Affairs Council of Charlotte. If you want details on that, go to WFAE.org. And as we were discussing in the previous segment, he has been everywhere constantly for the past 40 years. He was an ambassador to six different countries in the Middle East in the 1990s and 2000s. We went through the entire first segment without mentioning the T word, but I do want to ask you about President Trump in this context. In November of last year, you co-authored an essay titled Dismantling the Foreign Service in the New York Times, and you wrote that with Nicholas Burns, a former Undersecretary of State. And in that essay, the two of you sharply criticized the Trump administration for putting the State Department and the Foreign Service at risk. Since then, Mike Pompeo has replaced Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. And I'm wondering how much, if at all, things have changed because of the new Secretary of State.
Well, it's a great question, Eric. It's really important for the United States to manage its way through the multiple crises the world is throwing at us. You need a solid foreign service that has the people who have the skills, that have the resources to be able to analyze and advise on what's going on in crunchy places out there and help the policymakers get to sound policies. Rex Tillerson did extraordinary damage to our capabilities in that area. We saw the Foreign Service, for example, that hired about 380 new officers in calendar 2016, bring in less than 100 in calendar 2017. As anyone with experience in large organizations can tell you, that is damage today, tomorrow, and the day after tomorrow. For 20 years, you're going to have that gap.
Generational problems.
Exactly. Now, I didn't know Mike Pompeo well. I'd met him a couple of times when he was in Congress, but I did go down to Washington after he was nominated at his request to talk a little bit about the State Department and the Foreign Service. He has a reputation of being an individual who does understand and appreciate complex bureaucracies. Army vet, West Point graduate, he got that about the Army. He certainly had that reputation at CIA. And what we're seeing, this still has yet to unfold fully, we've seen him put forward some very capable career officers for key positions. David Hale, one of the, perhaps the finest diplomat of his generation, has been put forward as the number three official in the State Department, Undersecretary for Political Affairs. Carol Perez, another senior career diplomat, will be taking over as Director General. That is our key management position for both the Civil Service and the Foreign Service. So he's done some positive things. I'm more concerned, though, about the so-called geographic bureaus in the State Department, Africa, Europe, Near East, East Asia. I'm not seeing a lot of career people put up for those positions. So we'll see. But generally speaking, I think Secretary Pompeo is, what the State Department needed when it needed it. This has nothing to do with ideology. Foreign Service is apolitical. We don't make policy. We advise on it, and then we execute it. But to have a secretary who appreciates the organization is a huge step forward for us.
Did Secretary Tillerson ever seek your advice during his tenure?
No, he did not.
And did you know him at all previously?
I knew him slightly. When I was ambassador to Iraq in the latter part of my tour, late 2008, he was the CEO of ExxonMobil.
Sure.
And we worked pretty hard and successfully to be sure that ExxonMobil got one of the major oil field service contracts, which is why I was so surprised by the attitude that he took when he became Secretary of State. He knew what the Foreign Service does, that ambassadors can go in and advocate for him. ExxonMobil is a huge organization. It's more like a country in some respects than a company, and it has its own foreign policy, if you will. So I thought when he was named that this was going to be a great appointment. I have no idea why he took the approaches he did. Clearly, it was not at the behest of President Trump.
I was going to ask you from, so you have the administration side, obviously. What's your sense of Congress and its support of the State Department and diplomacy right now?
Again, it's a great question. I think there are two parts to it, at least. One good thing that came out of the Tillerson tenure was an appreciation publicly expressed by a number of members of Congress that that 33% budget cut would not stand. That was the pass from OMB to the State Department. Tillerson elected not to contest it. Well, Congress stepped up on that. Said, we're not going to do this. We need that building, that department, and we need our Foreign Service. We in the Foreign Service are not exactly accustomed to hearing members of Congress say that we may be something other than a net liability for the nation.
That sounds like a man with a lot of experience.
If you want to talk dog years, you would calculate those, at least in my case, the number of hours spent testifying before various congressional committees. So that's something to build on, that there is an awareness out there. Some other things that have happened recently, not so good. The Benghazi process. The whole thrust of that at the end of the day was to make the career Foreign Service totally risk averse. That if you send somebody out there and she gets popped, and it happens. I mean, we do lose diplomats. But to turn that into a show trial, which is basically what Congress did with the Benghazi Committee, is really dangerous, because if it's zero risk, that means your diplomats in hard places, if they're there at all, are going to be bunkered down taking zero risk. So we've got to overcome that mentality. And since Secretary Pompeo was a very vocal member of that Benghazi Committee, he now gets the opportunity to maybe produce a more nuanced message about taking risks, how you manage them, and why it's necessary for the good of the country.
Now, as you and I are speaking, Secretary Pompeo is visiting Pakistan and India, trying to limit the increasing influence of China on the region while pushing yet again for greater cooperation on fighting terrorism. What's realistic when you, and I know one trip obviously is not going to solve everything, but what's realistic in terms of incremental progress in that direction for Secretary Pompeo and the administration, I should say?
Well, Eric, if your supposition is that this trip is really about, although it's a visit to India and Pakistan, and it's really about China, that is one dimension of it. Clearly, the Indians have never really been that close to China. Their external patron, if you will, during the Cold War was the Soviet Union, not China. Conversely, in Pakistan, China is the country they hold up as an example of benign and positive international intervention in Pakistan. Which is not wholly true. The Chinese get great press in Pakistan, but they do very little to assist the Pakistanis, for example, in long-term economic development, to strengthen their defensive capabilities, and so forth. I'm very pleased the Secretary is going there. I would hope that would foretell a shift in policy from where we are now in Pakistan. I think the subcontinent, in many respects, has to be seen in its own terms, not through the lens of great power contests. So we'll see what happens there. China is a very complicated challenge for us. In some areas, clearly we are competitors, if not adversaries. The maritime excursions the Chinese have made in the East are troublesome to us and to our allies. In other areas, like Central Asia, China may turn out, with its One Belt, One Road initiative, to be a force for stability in places like Afghanistan. So, again, it's complex, it's nuanced. There is no one-size-fits-all in the evolving U.S. relationship with the subcontinent or with China.
I want to go back to the Middle East, where obviously the bulk of your experience was, and ask you about Syria. I would guess that you hear questions about Syria wherever you go. But just from a pure layman's perspective, here we have Syria suffering through a civil war since 2011. 350,000 people have died. Many more I think it's 11 million, have been forced away from their homes and fled. You have problems with sanitation and health and the worst imaginable circumstances. Russia is helping Bashar al-Assad. This is a really ridiculous general question, but why can't Syria be fixed, or what could be done to make the situation at least a little bit better than what we see day to day?
Well, that is an interesting proposition. Much is said and written about the dramatic differences between the Obama and the Trump administration. So, you know, I got some good news and I got some bad news. On issues of national security, there is actually maybe more continuity than there is difference on places like Syria. The bad news is that it looks like both administrations, Obama and Trump, are getting it wrong. The Obama approach to Syria was, I'm not going there. I don't care how many Syrian civilians get killed, I am not going there. And he certainly proved that as we stood by doing nothing as civilians were murdered by the tens of thousands in Aleppo. The fall of Aleppo was horrific. Well, the Trump administration is kind of in the same place. We are now looking at the battle for Idlib province, mm-hmm. which no one has heard. It's, mm-hmm. you know, the northwest of Syria on the Turkish border. And it's going to be pretty awful. What the regime and its external backers, Iran and Russia, have done is basically funnel all of the rebel fighters of different organizations and a lot of civilians up into Idlib so they could straighten their lines and get everything settled out of there and then turn to Idlib, which is what they're doing right now. So the Obama administration stood by as civilians were murdered daily. The Trump administration is pretty much doing the same thing. They made a statement warning the regime and Russia about Idlib. Yeah, well, I don't really think that's going to get a whole lot of consideration because they're pretty confident out there in Damascus and Moscow and Tehran. We're not going to do anything.
I want to ask you specifically about, you mentioned Obama's approach. And of course, one of the first things that people point to is that red line statement on Syria. In your view, would Syria rank as one of the biggest foreign policy blunders of that administration?
Still to be seen. It depends on what happens next. I could see maybe it'll rock along. After all, we don't care whether civilians are killed out there or not, so we can ignore that. A distant people in a far place, who cares? Beyond that, we're just going to have to see what happens next. We may be thoroughly sick and tired of the Syrian civil war. You know, I get that. It's been going on for 7 years. Well, I spent more of my life than was healthy in Lebanon, 6 years during its civil war. That war raged for 15 years, and it was less complex by a long shot, both on the international and the local levels, than Syria is. So, you know, maybe Idlib is going to fall in the coming months with horrendous loss of life. That's not the end of the story. It's going to go on and on and on, something we don't really seem to understand or appreciate.
Is there a comparison between Iraq under Saddam Hussein and Syria under Bashar al-Assad in terms of, you famously and sadly pointed out some of the consequences if the U.S. went into Iraq and many of those played out. I don't know how Syria could get worse, but do you see, is there any argument for keeping Assad in place, so to speak?
Well, first, a little bit of modesty and humility are necessary. We Americans don't do modesty and humility terribly well, but we might. We might take another run at it. How much influence do we really have? When President Obama back in 2011 said Assad must go, words to that effect, you know, that was an uh-oh moment. So precisely how are we going to make that happen? You know, diplomacy 101 is if you're going to announce a policy, be sure you've got the means to execute it. I think President Obama was assuming that it'd be like Mubarak in Egypt, Gaddafi in Libya, Ben Ali in Tunisia, that, you know, the forces of the Arab Spring would push him out. Well, if he had known, or his advisors had known, Syria's unique history, they would have known that that wasn't going to happen in Syria. So, again, it's not going to be for us to say, does he go or does he stay? We do not have the commitment or the power, quite frankly, to compel either outcome. I have said from the beginning, guys, he's going to stay. The Iranians are not going to let him go. And that's how this is playing out. Now, to what end? Let's go back to that famous red line. Here again, we see continuity between the administrations. They both established it as a red line. Trump actually did something highly symbolic about it. To what end? Well, the way it was framed up, the message that is being delivered, certainly by this administration, is that, hey, guys, you regime in Damascus and your foreign backers, let's be clear. We don't really care how you kill your people. You know, have a ball. Just don't use chemical weapons. So it says any other form of death is okay with us. Keep going with those barrel bombs. We're not going to say a word. Just don't use chemical weapons. There was a way that could have been framed differently and effectively to say this is not a Syria issue. This is a global issue. Chemical weapons anywhere in the world are something we will not tolerate. We didn't frame it globally, with the result that the on both sides of the fight, the American position is clear. Kill away, just don't use chemicals.
Again, we're speaking with former U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker, talking about the Middle East and foreign relations. And your long career, you mentioned one of the less pleasant aspects of your career was congressional testimony. I do want to ask you when we come back about the late Senator John McCain, who was very much involved in foreign affairs throughout his lengthy career and obviously in the military before that. Stay with us here on Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and we'll be right back with more with former Ambassador Ryan Crocker. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and today in the studio we have former U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker. He's in town. He is speaking to the World Affairs Council of Charlotte, and not only that, you also are going to be heading out to the university, correct?
I am, Eric. That's important for me. Once you've been in the Foreign Service, you tend to kind of want to encourage its future. So part of my message out on campus is going to be to the students, think about the Foreign Service. Most of them haven't because most of them don't know what it is. It's a great opportunity for people who may more resemble the total America to take part in the shaping of its foreign policies. It is not the exclusive preserve of East or West Coast elites. Mm-hmm. It's the Foreign Service of the United States, and I would just like to do my little bit to raise the consciousness of students at a great university that that should be on their options list. You can't go into the Foreign Service if you don't know what's there.
That's very well said. And you mentioned earlier, I want to stay with that for just a moment, you mentioned earlier this is an apolitical role, even though you're obviously engulfed in a lot of political matters. Just give me a flavor of how you navigate through that.
It's simple in concept, like a lot of things, harder in practice. You take the 2003 invasion of Iraq. I was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State at the time in the Near East Bureau with responsibilities for Iraq and the Gulf. I was not a big fan of a military intervention. Not that Saddam didn't deserve it. He most manifestly did deserve to be overthrown and later executed. But because of what could happen when you take the lid off. I wasn't predictive, particularly. I just said, look, have you guys thought about this? You take over somebody's country, it's not third and fourth order consequences, it's 50th and 60th order. I advised along those lines. Policy was decided differently. And within a couple of weeks of our entry into Iraq in spring of 2003, I was out there. And I was out there at the behest of, among others, Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, who had been a leading proponent of the intervention. But neither he nor I considered for a moment that I wouldn't or shouldn't go. Of course I'd go. I had prior service in Iraq. I kind of knew the place a bit. I spoke the language. Of course I should go. It doesn't matter what I thought of the decision to intervene. That's done. We're there. And as a Foreign Service officer, just like our military officers, that's what we've done. I've got to do my level best to make it work.
Let me ask you, though, in terms of politics, I want to ask you a couple things. First is, I mentioned the late Senator John McCain. Americans spent the past week honoring his service, not only in the military, but obviously in the U.S. Senate as well. What kind of relationship did you have with him? How often did you interact with him during your career?
Well, John McCain is one of America's great. I think a lot of us knew that before his death. We're certainly coloring in that picture now. I was at the service at the National Cathedral on Saturday. I was very privileged to get to know him. I'd known him before, but Iraq was the time that I really got a sense of who he was as a United States Senator and as someone who aspired to run our country. He was a terrific backer of the efforts that I was making, as well as, of course, on the military side with Dave Petraeus and later Ray Odierno. But he got the diplomacy thing, that the surge only worked, surge of U.S. troops only worked if it could lead to political progress. So we spent a lot of time together talking about what we were achieving, how we could do better, and so forth. As chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, he got the diplomatic bit and was hugely supportive of what I was trying to do, even though it was manifestly unpopular in the country, including in the state of Arizona. It was the right thing to do. And that, if I were asked to sum up John McCain in one sentence, he did the right thing over and over and over again, from the time he was a prisoner in Vietnam all the way up till his death. We lost a great American last week.
And many people have pointed out that while he supported the invasion of Iraq, he also very clearly and very loudly and very publicly came out against waterboarding, against anything that was close to torture. He had firsthand knowledge, as we all know. That too is an interesting part of his personality and his character, that you have someone who is supporting a military action but is also saying, wait a minute, we have to still live up to our ideals. I mean, that may sound very basic and fundamental to people, but you know Washington, that is unusual.
Eric, that is a truly great question, because that we have a tension in our national security and foreign policies between our interests and our values. We're the only major country in the world for which values are a component of national security. It's who we are. And John McCain, just in who he was, personified that. No one tougher in advocating or participating in a fight, but who believed passionately in the rules of war. And that is, you do not torture prisoners, because he knows what it felt like. So in his person, he bridged that duality, that tension, as really no one else ever could.
In the final weeks of his life, in July, after President Trump held the joint news conference in Helsinki with Vladimir Putin, Senator McCain said, quote, "President Trump proved not only unable but unwilling to stand up to Putin. He and Putin seemed to be speaking from the same script, as the president made a conscious choice to defend a tyrant and to grant Putin an uncontested platform to spew propaganda and lies to the world." Was he right about that?
Well, that was pure John McCain. Over the top? Yeah, that's what John McCain does. And in doing so, becomes really the conscience of a nation. Is that all true? No, I don't think it is. But he was putting out that warning flag. Be careful. The world is not safe for democracy. Putin would be the poster boy for that. So if you're taking a soft line with Putin, boy, consider the consequences. And again, that was pure McCain speak. All of us who've dealt with him or been in front of his committee, know what the signs are when you need to duck for incoming.
And as I said, you are very practiced at being apolitical in a political realm. But I am curious, when you see the president meet with Vladimir Putin, when you see the summit in Singapore with Kim Jong-un, what do you make of this style of diplomacy that he is carrying out here in recent months?
Let's see what happens. A lot has been said, pro and con, about North Korea and its leader and his outreach. Well, President did something none of his predecessors could or would do. He sat down with the ruler of North Korea. I think that's a good thing, whatever else comes of it. To bring North Korea into the world, even symbolically, is, I think, a lot better for the security of all of us than having them out there as the hermit kingdom. Will this lead to something larger? I don't know. I'm pleased that the president will be meeting with the president of South Korea and the United Nations to check signals. He's been in touch with the Chinese, of course, and with the Japanese. So I'm not sure we have a net negative there at all. I am more concerned about Russia. I think it's pretty clear and has been clear for some time where Putin is trying to take the country. And because Russia matters, it will have its impact elsewhere. We're already seeing that in some parts of the former Eastern Europe. I would be with another great Princetonian, George Kennan, on this, who wrote the famous long telegram identifying early on the nature of the Soviet regime. Well, I think a lot of that applies today. Russia is still Russia, whether ruled by czars or Soviets, or in this case, authoritarians. I would be a lot more cautious with Russia than the president seems to think is the way he's going.
This may sound like a ludicrous question, considering the overwhelming evidence and the number of people who have said that Russia interfered in the 2016 elections, but I'm going to ask you anyway, do you have any shred or scintilla of doubt that Vladimir Putin was playing with the American election in 2016?
Well, I personally don't really have any shreds of doubt about that. But in fairness, I have to acknowledge I didn't have any shreds of doubt about the presence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq either in 2003. Might be useful to take another look at that stuff.
life is tricky, I think, is what you're telling me.
You got it.
I want to go back to when you were discussing Kim Jong-un in the meeting with President Trump. That's an interesting perspective that you have because, as I'm sure you're aware, plenty of people came away from that saying not only that Kim Jong-un won't live up to what he's promised, but that merely by sitting with him, the president was conferring an endorsement of sorts, a tacit endorsement of the leader of North Korea. It sounds like you are okay with that potential stain or blight for the betterment of the world by just engaging them in broader diplomatic relations. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, it is, Eric. I mean, look, I was a career diplomat. By definition, I believe in talking to people. Those can be pretty...
You've come to the right place.
Charlotte does talk, yeah. So, yeah, I think any kind of engagement, anything that pulls Kim Jong-un out of that tiny little hermitage of his, introduces him to a broader world, I think is a net good. Will this lead to something broader again? I don't know. As much as the Trump meeting with Kim Jong-un, I thought the little dance that he danced with the president of South Korea on the DMZ was quite telling. So anything that is going to take us further away from a nuclear adventure involving North Korea, I think that's good.
Do you think we're going to see an official end to the Korean War in the near future?
Well, you can quote me here. No.
You didn't hesitate on that answer at all. Again, we're speaking with former Ambassador Ryan Crocker today on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. He is in town to speak to the World Affairs Council of Charlotte. I wanted to ask you about Saudi Arabia. We had the tour by the Crown Prince. We have had some liberalization, much touted by the Crown Prince. But at the same time, you have horrible things going on in Yemen, where civilians are dying from airstrikes, a coalition that includes the United States. So what do you think is happening in Saudi Arabia? How legitimate is this modernization that we're being told about?
Eric, I'm going to come back to that modesty thing again, and even humility. Saudi Arabia, in my view, is probably the second most complex political culture in the Middle East. Iran would be first. We have one thing in common. We understand either country very little. In the case of Saudi Arabia, the workings of the royal family are almost completely opaque to us. We don't know what goes on in those family consultations. So we really don't know what is driving the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. We do know that it's a tricky business. You can see it in one particular area, I think, that he did make that initiative to allow women to drive in the kingdom. At the same time, he is rounding up dissidents, including women, and prepared to levy some very harsh sentences. So is he pro-female engagement or is he anti-female engagement? Again, I don't think we really know. He has to juggle a lot of things that we're not really aware of because we don't have a window into family dynamics. We need to understand that we don't understand. All of that said, when you look at the Yemen war and other things, we don't have the choice in that region of autocracies versus democracies. And there's only one fully developed democracy, which is Israel. It's a choice between order and disorder. And on that, Saudi Arabia is a force of order. So they're doing things we don't like. It's not going to get any better if we pull back and publicly criticize them. It will get worse. In Yemen, we kind of created that dynamic, and it shows how the relationship started deteriorating under President Obama. The Saudis didn't ask us what we thought about starting an air war in Yemen. They told us they were doing it 72 hours before they struck. Made it clear that this was not going to be a consultation on go or not go. Could we provide enablers? If not, they'd go alone. That's how bad the relationship had gotten under President Obama. Now, again, they are a force of order. We need to do everything we can to get them to dial back in Yemen. It is a nightmare in terms of the whole-scale murder of civilians. We're not going to be able to do that unless they come to believe that we will back them, as we traditionally have since 1945.
We will have to leave it there. I could speak to you for 3 hours, but you probably have other things to do. Ryan Crocker, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Eric. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks, and go to WFAE.org if you want to get more details on the ambassador's visit.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.